This is VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Dan Novak. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, the Taliban on Tuesday announced an interim cabinet that placed longtime members of the group in top jobs. Many had led the 20-year battle against the U.S.-led coalition and the Afghan government. Interim Prime Minister Mullah Hassan Akhund headed the Taliban government in Kabul during the last years of its rule. Sirajuddin Haghani, son of the founder of the Haghani Network, will be the interior minister. The U.S. State Department considers the Haghani Network a terrorist organization. It is not known what position in the government Taliban Supreme Leader Mullah Habibullah Akhundzada will take. There was no evidence of non-Taliban in the new interim government. That is a main demand of the international community. A Taliban spokesman made the announcement. He did not say how long the interim government would serve. So far, the Taliban have not shown any desire to hold elections. The spokesman's announcement came hours after Taliban members fired into the air to force protesters in Kabul to break up. They also arrested several reporters. It was the second time in less than 1 week that the Taliban used such measures to break up a demonstration in the Afghan capital. The demonstrators had gathered outside the embassy of Pakistan to accuse the country of aiding the Taliban's attack on the Panjshir area. The Taliban said Monday they had captured the area. Afghanistan's former government had often accused Pakistan of aiding the Taliban, which Pakistan denied. Many women were among the protesters Tuesday. Some of them carried signs that denounced Pakistan. On Saturday, Taliban special forces fired their weapons into the air to end a protest march in Kabul by Afghan women demanding equal rights. The Taliban again moved quickly to end Tuesday's protest when it arrived near the presidential home. They fired their weapons into the air and arrested several reporters covering the demonstration. In one case, the Taliban beat a reporter and then arrested him. He was detained for several hours. "This is the third time I have been beaten by the Taliban covering protests," he told the Associated Press on condition he not be named. "I won't go again to cover a demonstration. It's too difficult for me," he added. A reporter from Afghanistan's popular Tolo News was detained for 3 hours by the Taliban before being freed along with his equipment and the video of the demonstration. In the northern city of Mazar-e-Sharif, 4 airplanes being used to move about 2,000 fleeing Afghans were still at the airport. Malawi Abdullah Mansour is the Taliban official overseeing the city's airport. He said only people with valid travel documents will be permitted to leave the country. Most of the passengers are believed to be Afghans without correct travel documents. Taliban members say they are trying to find out who among the estimated 2,000 people have valid travel documents. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in Qatar on Tuesday that the Taliban had promised safe passage for all seeking to leave Afghanistan with valid travel documents. He said the United States would hold the Taliban to that promise. It's my understanding that the Taliban has not denied exit to anyone holding a valid document, but they have said those without valid documents at this point can't leave, he said. He added, because all of these people are grouped together, that's meant that flights have not been allowed to go. The State Department is also working with the Taliban to permit additional airplane flights from Kabul for people seeking to leave Afghanistan, Blinken said.
American states that ban face coverings in schools may be discriminating against students with disabilities, U.S. Department of Education officials say. The Department of Education Office for Civil Rights has opened investigations into 5 states that ban face coverings or masks. The states are Iowa, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Utah. Suzanne Goldberg is the department's Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights. She informed the states of the investigation, saying that they could be in violation of the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA. The 1990 law bans discrimination against people with disabilities and requires that children with disabilities receive a fair education. Goldberg said in a letter that the investigation will focus on whether students with disabilities who are at heightened risk for severe illness from COVID-19 are prevented from safely returning to in-person education in violation of federal law. The administration of President Joe Biden has said it would fight back against efforts by Republican state lawmakers to prevent mask mandates in schools. Those against the requirements say it is a matter of personal freedom. They argue that it should be up to parents and individuals to decide. In the state of Tennessee, Republican Governor Bill Lee signed an executive order on August 16th, letting parents opt out of any requirement that children wear masks in school. 2 legal actions have since been filed against the order, including one saying that it violates the ADA. 4 other states, Arizona, Arkansas, Florida, and Texas, have also passed laws or signed executive orders banning mask mandates in schools. But the states are not currently under investigation because court orders have blocked the bans. In Florida, a court ruled on August 27th that school systems may go against the governor's order and require students to wear masks. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has said that wearing masks should be up to parents and not the government. He has also suggested that wearing masks hurts kids' ability to learn and communicate. The Florida Department of Education said they would appeal the court's ruling. Sarah Lee is a mother of 2 10-year-old children attending school in Florida's Leon County. She said her children do not mind wearing masks at all. In fact, I pick them up, and I'm like, "You can take your mask off now," Lee said. Dr. Rochelle Walensky is director of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, or CDC. At a briefing on COVID-19 on July 27th, she told reporters, "Children should return to full-time in-person learning in the fall with proper prevention strategy in place." Walensky recommended that all students, teachers, workers, and visitors wear a mask in schools. The recommendation is in effect for both unvaccinated and vaccinated people. A recent CDC study says since the health agency updated its guidelines on mask wearing, parents have gotten more worried about schools opening up in person. Before July 27th, 58% of parents asked said they wanted their children attending school in person full time. But after the new guidance, that number fell to 43%. Meanwhile, COVID infections among children have increased by 5 times over the past month, says the American Academy of Pediatrics. Children under 12 are currently unable to get COVID vaccinations, and children with certain disabilities and health problems are at greater risk of severe coronavirus infection and death. Vaccine makers Pfizer-BioNTech and Moderna say they are developing a vaccine safe for children aged 5 to 11. A school system in Texas closed recently until after the Labor Day holiday when 2 of its teachers died of COVID-19. Robin Lake is the director of the Center for Reinventing Public Education. The organization has researched schools' reopening plans and coronavirus prevention policies. "Our school systems should have had strong safety and quarantine plans in place months ago," Lake said on Twitter. "Anyone watching the science should have known fall reopening was going to be very difficult." Miguel Cardona is the U.S. Secretary of Education. He said in a statement that it is simply unacceptable that state leaders are putting politics over the health and education of the students they took an oath to serve. I'm Dan Novak.
Help protect yourself against the new coronavirus, wash your hands for 20 seconds with soap and water before you eat, after using the toilet, and after touching anything many other people touch, like a seat on a public bus. If you cannot wash your hands with soap and water, use an alcohol-based hand sanitizer that contains at least 60% alcohol. Taking these steps can help prevent not only the new coronavirus disease, but also colds, flu, and other viruses. For more information, visit the following websites: the World Health Organization at www.who.int or the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention at www.cdc.gov.
From VOA Learning English. Welcome to The Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. President James Madison retired after 8 years in office. His Republican Party chose another Virginian, James Monroe, as its next presidential candidate. The opposition Federalist Party had almost disappeared by the time of the election in 1816. James Monroe easily won the election, but not everyone was happy with the result. After all, Monroe was the fourth president from the state of Virginia. The situation caused hard feelings among political leaders in other areas, especially the states of New England. Monroe sought to improve this situation. He wanted to give the top four jobs in his cabinet to men from each of the nation's four major areas: the Northeast, the South, the West, and the Middle Atlantic coast. But he could find no Westerner who would take the job as head of the War Department. So he had cabinet ministers from only three of the four areas. The West was not represented. Despite the political concerns, most Americans liked Monroe and welcomed his presidency. Historian Harlow Giles Unger has written more than 20 books, including one about James Monroe. Mr. Unger says Monroe was one of America's most beloved presidents. He had been Secretary of State and Secretary of War at the same time under President Madison. He had also been a diplomat under President Thomas Jefferson and helped carry out the Louisiana Purchase, which doubled the size of the country. And Monroe had fought in the Revolutionary War and in the War of 1812.
So Monroe came out of the War of 1812 as a hero, and he and his wife, his beautiful wife Elizabeth, moved into what was a blackened hulk of a presidential mansion. And workers slathered on these thick coats of white paint, and really so thick that it gleamed white.
Harlow Unger says the new president sought to improve the country's safety. Monroe wanted to prevent any more invasions and to extend the country's natural defenses. One of the first problems he faced was in East Florida, in land which is now part of the state of Florida. The area borders the Atlantic Ocean and the Gulf of Mexico. At that time, East Florida belonged to Spain, but Spain controlled only a few towns in the area. The rest was controlled by criminals, escaped slaves, and former British soldiers. The area was also home to Native American Indians of the Seminole and Creek tribes. Sometimes people from East Florida would enter the state of Georgia and attack American citizens. One serious fight involved Seminole Indians and people just across the Georgia border. Monroe ordered General Andrew Jackson to march against the Indians. Jackson was a hero of the War of 1812 against Britain. He sent a message to President Monroe. It said, "Let me know in any way that the United States wants possession of the Florida Territory, and in 60 days it will be done." Jackson received no answer to his letter. He believed the silence meant that he was free to seize Florida. He quickly gathered a force of soldiers and marched toward Florida. General Jackson failed to capture any Indians, but he seized two Spanish towns, St. Mark's and Pensacola. He also arrested two British subjects. The two men were tried by a military court. They were found guilty of spying and giving guns to the Indians. Both were executed. President Monroe called a cabinet meeting as soon as he learned of Jackson's actions. All the ministers, except Secretary of State John Quincy Adams, believed that Jackson had gone too far, but they decided not to denounce him in public. Secretary Adams prepared messages to Britain and Spain about the incidents. His message to Britain carefully stated the activities of the two British subjects in Florida and explained why they were executed. Britain agreed not to take any action. Adams' message to Spain explained the situation this way. Spain had failed to keep the peace along the border as it had promised to do in a treaty. The United States had sent soldiers into Florida only to defend its citizens on the American side. The United States recognized that Florida belonged to Spain, but if Americans were forced to enter Florida again in self-defense, the United States might not return the territory to Spain. Spain had a choice. It could send enough soldiers to keep order in Florida, or it could give Florida to the United States. Spain really had no choice. At that time, Spain's colonies in South America were rebelling. All had declared their independence. José de San Martín led the struggle in Argentina. Bernardo O'Higgins was in Chile. And Simón Bolívar created the Republic of Great Colombia in the north. Spain's forces could not be sent to Florida. They were needed in South America. So the King of Spain agreed to give Florida to the United States. In exchange, the United States agreed to pay $5 million to American citizens who had damage claims against Spain. Historian Harlow Unger says the negotiations with Spain led to more than just Florida. He says President Monroe and Spanish officials also agreed on the boundaries of the Louisiana Purchase. They set the boundaries on the very top of the Rocky Mountains in the central west of the United States. The mountains created a natural border. Mr. Unger says they extended American territory into the northwest edge of the continent to what are now the states of Washington and Oregon. In other words, he says, Monroe moved the American frontier to the Pacific Ocean.
He really stretched the nation into an empire that reached from sea to shining sea.
With the new growth of the nation, tens of thousands of people began moving west. They built houses, started farms, and created towns.
And it was the first time in world history, really, that any sovereign state had granted so much land to people that were not of noble birth. And this expanded the strength of the American population. For the first time now, thousands, tens of thousands of Americans became landowners. With the ownership of land, these people were now, Americans, thousands of them, were now able to vote for the first time, were able to run for office for the first time, and really direct the course of their communities and their nations. It empowered the American people, and they absolutely worshipped Monroe for his efforts.
Harlow Unger says that with the strength and unity of the American people behind him, Monroe could make an important decision about international relations. The issue was the rebelling Spanish colonies in South America. The King of Spain did not want the United States to recognize the colonies' independence, and Spain asked European countries to help it put down the rebellions. Britain wanted no part of the Spanish proposal. It was trading heavily with these new Latin American countries. Spanish or even French control of this area would destroy or limit this trade. So Britain proposed a joint statement with the United States to say that neither country wanted any of Spain's territory in the New World. Britain also wanted the United States to join in opposing the handover of any of Spain's American territories to any other power in Europe. Most of President Monroe's advisors urged him to accept the British offer. Secretary of State Adams opposed it. He did not believe the United States should tie itself to any European power, even Britain. Monroe accepted the advice of his Secretary of State. He included Adams' ideas in his message to Congress in December 1823. This part of the message became known as the Monroe Doctrine. The president said no European power should, in the future, try to establish a colony anywhere in the Americas. He said the political system of the European powers was very different from that of the Americas. Monroe said any attempt to extend this European system to any of the Americas would threaten the peace and safety of the United States. The president also said the United States had not interfered with the colonies of any European power in South America and would not do so in the future. But Monroe added, a number of these former colonies had become independent countries, and the United States had recognized their independence. We would see it as an unfriendly act, he said, for any European power to try to oppress or control these new American countries in any way. At the same time, Monroe said, the United States never had and never would take part in any war among the European powers. This statement by Monroe was only part of a presidential message to Congress, but it clearly stated one of the most important of America's foreign policies. The country was enjoying a time of good feelings under Monroe, but an old problem was about to return and divide the country again. I'm Steve Ember, inviting you to join us next time for The Making of a Nation, American History from VOA, Learning English.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.